Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening and welcome to the special edition of Hemiscope. I'm Peter Smith. Tonight, we bring you documentary producer Laura Castañeda, whose latest work offers an intimate look at the Mexican migrants who were caught in San Diego's wildfires. Also an essay on the pink tide in Latin America. But first, the struggle for human rights as fought by the indigenous peoples of Latin America. My guest is Rodolfo Stavenhagen, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at El Colegio de México, and the former Special Rapporteur for the Human Rights of Indigenous People at the United Nations. Professor Stavenhagen is here as the keynote speaker for a conference on indigenous peoples sponsored by the Center for Iberian and Latin American Studies at the University of California, San Diego. Rodolfo, welcome.
Peter, it's a pleasure being here.
Rodolfo, I've admired your work for nearly half a century. You're a leading expert on the plight and the trials and tribulations of indigenous peoples in Latin America and elsewhere. For Latin America, what have been the biggest changes that have occurred in the past half century?
As far as indigenous peoples are concerned, I think there have been many changes which are very important to notice, even though the general public isn't always aware of them, which is the emergence of indigenous peoples as new political actors, as new socially recognized actors in a number of Latin American countries. They have become organized, they take part in elections, they have their militant organizations, they are placing their demands on the public agenda, and they have become legally recognized in a large number of Latin American countries. There have been legal reforms, constitutional reforms, where for the first time, indigenous peoples are recognized as actors in their own society, as subjects and actors of the law, and also as bearers of human rights.
How did this come about? Is it a result of the activism of indigenous peoples themselves, or did society change?
I think there are a number of factors that we should take into account. The indigenous peoples who have been for so many decades and centuries the victims of oppression, of discrimination, of genocide, massacres, forced policies of assimilation and integration and so forth, they have become actors in turn. They have established their militant organizations. In some countries, during the last few decades, they have participated in guerrilla warfare, in revolutionary movements. They have created and been able to have an intellectual elite, an ideologically militant and activist intellectual elite that has helped them to identify their problems, to negotiate with governments, and to place on the public agenda what ails them most, which is, of course, a whole series of human rights violations that they've been the victims of. Secondly, I think there has been a process that you have described, Peter, in your own work, of democratization in Latin America, of the opening up of society from the traditional oligarchic, authoritarian, sometimes highly authoritarian states, to a more democratic and participation and participative society. And of course, indigenous peoples have been part of that democratic change as well.
Rodolfo, you and I are academics. Let me raise an academic point. How do we define an indigenous person or group? What is the definition? Is it the language? Is it other attributes? Is it ethnicity?
There is no hard and fast definition that can be used worldwide. And there is a lot of debate on who is not an indigenous person, how to define an indigenous group, an indigenous community. But in Latin America, there is experience ever from colonial times. The indigenous peoples are, of course, the descendants of the populations who lived there before the arrival of the Europeans. They also have a history of identification as indigenous people, separate from the dominant group of people of European origin, and in many countries recently also separate from the mestizo group that arose from the mixture between Indians and non-Indians during colonial and post-colonial times. They also have a history of attachment to their lands and territories and identification with community life, which is recognized both by the members of the community as well as outsiders. And in general, there is a history of subordination, a history of discrimination, and there is also an identity of wanting to remain as indigenous people. So there are cultural criteria, for example, the linguistic criteria, which is being used by the census offices. You know, we have so and so many speakers of Mapuche or Aymara or Quiche or Maya or Nahuatl, wherever it is. And then that is identification enough. But it is not sufficient, because there are indigenous peoples who do not live in the rural areas, who have migrated to the cities or even abroad to the United States, and still identify themselves as indigenous, even when they have, when they no longer use their own language or have forgotten it, because there are cultural markers and cultural identities that remain over the generations. So it is in a way a subjective criterion, but also objectively based in cultural facts.
Now, in addition to being an academic rock star, Rodolfo, you have worked in the United Nations off and on and other international organizations over the years. Did that work alter your perspective or expand your perspective on indigenous peoples in general, and particularly in Latin America? Did you learn things that you would not have otherwise learned?
Absolutely, Peter. I have learned a lot over the last 7 years while I was carrying out this mandate as Special Rapporteur for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples for the United Nations Human Rights Council, because it has enabled me to visit indigenous communities all over Latin America, and not only in Latin America. I've been all over the world, because this has been a worldwide responsibility. But let's concentrate on Latin America at this point. I have visited communities in the Andes and in the Amazon jungles. I have visited rural and urban communities. I've had the opportunity to visit with families in their local settings and homes, and to see the women and children, and to speak with them about their own problems. Sometimes, for example, I've had meetings with indigenous women who don't want their indigenous men to be present when they complain to the Special Rapporteur of the United Nations about gender discrimination, sometimes in their own communities. But I've also spoken with the leaders of very militant organizations of indigenous peoples. Very often they're in opposition to the current government. And I've been able to talk with presidents and ministers and members of the cabinets and people who are engaged in deciding upon and carrying on the so-called indigenous policies of governments for indigenous peoples. I've spoken with people in the health services, with people in the educational sector, with people in the productive sector, with migrants, with internally displaced people and refugees. So it has really widened my perspective on what's happening with indigenous peoples around the world.
Sounds like a wonderful job. Let me ask you about South America, about Bolivia, which recently elected an indigenous person as president of the country. And that is, in many ways, for the public, seen as kind of a litmus test, or at least the most explicit example of empowerment of indigenous political movements. We see that in Bolivia and not in Peru, which also has a very large and substantial indigenous population. What explains the difference?
Well, my colleagues and your colleagues, Peter, who who study these issues, our friends, the political scientists and the anthropologists and the indigenous leaders themselves, of course, have all sorts of hypotheses and theories about these differences between Peru and Bolivia.
I want you to tell us the truth now.
Well, absolutely. This is the last word. No, joking aside, I think it's very complex, because though there are cultural identities between the indigenous peoples and the colonial history of Bolivia and Peru, who used to be, well, which used to be part of the same colony. The post-colonial and republican, and particularly the recent history of the two countries, has been quite different during the 20th century. I think one of the issues that has played a role in Bolivia in creating what we might call an awareness of indigenous identities and of the role of indigenous peoples was in the 1930s, the Chaco War between Bolivia and Paraguay, which began creating a nationalist awareness or conscience among a lot of members of the population.
Secondly, is that because the indigenous were conscripted for service in the military?
They were conscripted for service. They were taken out of their communities. They had to fight the petroleum company war that they didn't know anything about. And this created a certain kind of awareness and enabled some of them to become active militants in social organizations later on. The second major issue, of course, was the revolution of 1952, the MNR, Movimiento Nacional Revolution, which opened up Bolivia to more democratic participation.
And that revolution, just for the sake of a parenthesis, is often seen as comparable to even the Mexican Revolution or the Cuban Revolution or even Nicaragua, so that was a major historic watershed for Bolivia in 1952.
Absolutely, that's right. And it has been compared to the Mexican Revolution. And in fact, it carried out some policies which I believe were inspired by the Mexican Revolution that had taken place about 30 years before. Basically, the land reform, which enabled indigenous populations who had been tied to the largest states as serfs and peons, particularly in the highlands, to become owners of their own pieces of land. That, of course, didn't give them any political power, but it gave them a greater participation, a greater space for democratic participation. Secondly, there was an educational effort carried out by the government, and there was the organization of the Indians who worked in the mines. The trade unions.
Especially in the tin mines, right?
In the tin mines, in the highlands of Bolivia. And all of that helped create a movement, a cultural, social, and political movement of indigenous peoples, which finally, after many ups and downs, resulted in the electoral victory of Evo Morales, an Aymara Indian, for the MAS, the Movimiento al Socialismo, political party, his election as president of Bolivia.
Let me ask you about your own country, Mexico. You wrote a brilliant essay called Mexico's Unfinished Symphony, referring to the Zapatista revolt that broke out in 1994, and which various presidents have proclaimed that they would resolve in 15 minutes or half an hour or some other very short interval of time. And it continues. What's going on? How do we interpret Zapatismo? Was Subcomandante Marcos, the leader who was not indigenous himself, but who seeks or claims to represent indigenous movements and various kind of tendencies or explanations around it? What provoked that in the first place, and how come it's still going on?
Well, it was provoked by the long history of the discrimination and exclusion of indigenous peoples, particularly in southeastern Mexico. So in Chiapas, this organization, which is led by the Subcomandante Marcos, who has been in the area for many years, and who worked hard to organize the local indigenous communities into an organization, a network, called the Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional.
Named after Emiliano Zapata, the legendary revolutionary figure.
Of many years before, that's right. So at the beginning, actually, we called it the Neo-Zapatistas, the New Zapatistas.
But academics would do that.
Academics would do it, yes. But the name stuck. And I think they rightly named themselves after Zapata because their demands were inspired by the unfulfilled promises of the Mexican Revolution regarding the demands of Zapata 30 years earlier. And so the idea that Zapata rides again in Chiapas is still something that is widely used in Mexico. What are these demands? Demands for land, demands for justice, demands for social services, demands for dignity, demands for recognition, demands for political participation, all of this which has been denied over the years and the decades despite all this revolutionary rhetoric of the Mexican Revolution, it has been denied indigenous people. So that gave impetus to the uprising in 1994, which coincided with Mexico's entry into the North American Free Trade Agreement, a contrast between the Mexico of the so-called First World and the Mexico of the so-called Fourth World in among the Indians of Southeast Chiapas. Then Southeast Mexico in the state of Chiapas. Then there was the beginning of a negotiation between the government and the Zapatistas. And it lasted for about a year, and it ended in the Accords of San Andrés, because that's the name of the village where they were signed in Chiapas at the end of 1995. And nothing happened, because the government at the time of President Zedillo, which was a PRI government, the last PRI government that we have had to date, decided that they did not want to comply with the agreement that they had signed. So the Zapatistas walked away.
Excuse me, Vicente Fox was elected, and he was going to fix it in half an hour, he said.
Exactly. He said 15 minutes, actually, which was, of course, very rhetorical. But unfortunately, his government did nothing to try to solve these issues. He did present a constitutional reform initiative to the Congress, but which was not actually based on the San Andrés agreements, and the Zapatista movement, as well as other indigenous organizations, kept demanding that these accords be really complied with and be translated into law.
In 30 seconds, the new Felipe Calderón government
has so far not even addressed the issue of indigenous peoples.
We'll have to leave it there. But with voices like yours, we can continue to have hope. Rodolfo, thank you so much. When we return, a look at the making of the Devil's Breath. Last fall, the notorious Santa Ana winds brought much of San Diego to a standstill as numerous wildfires threatened to burn a path from the rural backcountry to the densely populated neighborhoods on the coast. 11 people died in those firestorms. And though the news reports tended to focus on the American victims and the extensive property damage, producer Laura Castañeda was struck by what was not covered. She wanted to know about the migrants who were also victims, trapped by the fires as they crossed the border into the United States. Laura, welcome to Hemiscope.
Thank you.
Tell us about the title of your program, The Devil's Breath. What does that mean?
Well, in doing some of the research, Peter, that I did before I started actually interviewing people for the documentary, I learned that the Native American community here in this region referred to the Santa Ana winds as the Devil's Breath.
The title is perfect. It's really provocative and sort of carries a very strong message. Now, what struck you about this incident? Why did you want to do this documentary?
Well, because I have been covering the border region for most of my career as a journalist, and I was appalled by the fact that it was really ignored, and not only locally, but just, you know, everybody that came here from CBS and NBC and ABC and all, you know, all the big names, nobody, you know, the only thing that was mentioned was a news clip that lasted about 30 seconds showing four bodies that were found near an area in the backcountry.
So you went after the story. How did you find families? How did you find the individuals? How did you manage to get stories out of people who might have been a little reticent because, in fact, the migrants were undocumented? Their relatives were undocumented as they were trying to cross the border.
Well, I started with some of the community leaders here in San Diego that I've known for quite some time. And I honestly do not think that I would have been able to find them had it not been for them, because they had contact with a lot of them. They were trying to help them search for the missing family members. They were trying to help them get back on their feet. You know, where do I go from here? And so they were the ones that really were instrumental in getting me to them. And on top of it, putting in a word to them and saying, you can trust this woman. We know her.
They've entered the U.S. illegally on foot about 9 in the morning near Tecate, about 50 miles east of San Diego. 55-year-old Jose Israel Hernandez and 39-year-old Juan Carlos Bautista Ocampo lead the way. This time, they're on their way back to San Marcos, where they work construction and gardening jobs. But after a short stop to rest, around noon, the men see thick black smoke in the distance. The flames keep getting closer and closer.
No fue mucho lo de la lumbre. Serían de 15 minutos o 20, pero se nos hizo una eternidad, pues. Al segundo regresó, pero ya regresó y se quedó acostado.
Se quemó de la cara, de los pies. Y yo creo que también se quebró por correr. Ya no podía caminar.
Cesar tries calling 911 again and again.
You know, as a journalist, I've always tried to take a step back and keep my emotions out of it. But something that was a little bit different for me this time is since I saw you last, actually, I have a baby now, a one-year-old. And one of the victims that died in the fire left behind four very young children, one-year-old, five, seven, and eight. And when you see what the father has to deal with now, even in the interview, while I'm interviewing him, you can hear on the air the children screaming and, you know, going about in the background. And that's just a constant reminder of what this man has to face.
Todo su cuerpo tapada con una sábana, cubierta la todo lo que es su frente, su cara.
You report some of the 911 calls, actually, on the video itself. Tell me about those. What was going on, and what reaction did it provoke in you?
Once I learned that they made multiple calls to 911, I immediately tried to start getting a hold of those calls, and it was like finding a needle in a haystack, because one can imagine how many calls were going into the 911 system on October 21st.
911.
Excuse me.
Do you speak English?
No.
Un momento. Are you the person that's lost?
Yeah.
Hold on. Un momento.
I'm sure there were many, many compassionate people in the call center that day, but in this particular group and these particular calls, some of the men that called were treated very rudely. They were transferred over and over again. It seemed that the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. And the bottom line is that after all those calls, nobody went to look for that man. And there's a very good chance that he survived up there 4 or 5 or 6 days, burned with third-degree burns, no food, no water, before another group, who was not a law enforcement agency, found his body. So it's very troubling.
Troubling. It is devastating. Laura, this is a most moving and important documentary. I congratulate you on it. Where can we see this?
UCTV, and probably the easiest way, instead of going to the website and looking for the repeats, is just to go to YouTube and go to the search engine and type in The Devil's Breath. You'll find it there.
You'll find it there. Thank you so very much. Next, thoughts on the pink tide in Latin America. I bring you news from Paraguay. From Paraguay, you say? That small, poor, undeveloped country somewhere in the middle of South America? Right. And the message is, the new left in Latin America is alive and well. One of the most striking developments over the past decade has been the rise of what has come to be known as Latin America's pink tide. Starting with Venezuela in 1998, the region has witnessed a surge of left-of-center electoral triumphs, most notably in Brazil, Argentina, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Nicaragua. Some observers believed, and many hoped, that this tide had crested in 2006 with narrow losses for populist candidates in Peru and Mexico. And now comes Paraguay and last month's election of Fernando Lugo, a former Catholic bishop and advocate of liberation theology, who defeated his nearest opponent by no less than 10 points, thus ending the 62-year reign of the Colorado Party, Paraguay's equivalent of Mexico's PRI. Lugo's victory marks a historic watershed. So what is this leftist trend, and what does it mean? First and foremost, the Pink Tide is a protest movement. It is a protest against conditions of poverty, inequality, and corruption. It is a protest against the inability or unwillingness of governments to promote effective social reform. It is a protest of citizens against impersonal economic forces and uncaring political leaders. Second, the Pink Tide amounts to a rejection of the neoliberal policies propounded by the Washington Consensus, free market policies designed to promote free trade, foreign investment, and reductions in state power. Poor people believe that the Washington Consensus favors privileged elites at the expense of suffering masses. Third, it is a broad collection of movements. It emerges from local conditions. It is not centralized. Its membership is fluid, and there is competition in its ranks. It is far from doctrinaire. Ideological inspiration comes from such diverse sources as nationalism, populism, indigenous tradition, Catholicism, and, yes, diluted forms of Marxism. It is, furthermore, a democratic trend. Its leaders have come to power through free and fair elections. They represent their citizens. To be sure, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela has moved in authoritarian directions, but others have not. And they are by no means all Chavistas. They might admire his ability to yank George Bush's chain and envy Chavez's petrodollar windfalls, but they seek to emulate neither his pronouncements nor his policies. Why should this matter to us? What difference does it make? Most fundamentally, Latin America's Pink Tide means that angry and disenchanted masses are expressing their discontent at the ballot box. They are not taking up arms, going to the hills, planting bombs, or engaging in terrorist conspiracies. They are voting. Democratic elections thus provide the region and the hemisphere with a kind of safety valve. That is a very good thing, not only for Latin America, but also for the United States. At the same time, the Pink Tide presents U.S. leaders with a challenge and an opportunity. The Bush administration has attempted to isolate Latin America's left-of-center leaders, denouncing them as unthinking puppets of either Hugo Chavez or the Castro brothers. That is a mistake. We can only hope that this will change in the wake of our own presidential election. Finally, the Pink Tide presents us with a crucial test: whether electoral democracy in the developing world can achieve meaningful social justice. That is one of the most critical questions of the 21st century. Let us hope that the answer is yes. This is Hemiscope, and I am Peter Smith. Thank you, and good night.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.